commend you for the supports and incentives that were provided to the DSPs. You know, again, the people who really provide all that day in, day out service and support so well. I think it's excellent that you did things that cheered them up, if nothing else, with the Christmas holiday contests and the and food supports and the Target gift cards, all the things that you listed. That's just great. And I really, it was so nice to see that you had some measurable outcomes in this application. And I would encourage you to really expand on that. I love information that really tells us exactly what happened because people were able to participate, how they felt about it, what they felt they gained. So thank you for that. And then I just wanted to ask, you know, we have this tricky school code problem, which I know you are all very well aware of. And I would just say that I would appreciate information that assures us that we're not doing things that the school districts can and or should be paying for. Well, that's it, just it. You know, again, along the same lines as the school code, a reminder that we should be payers of last resort. And so I see that a reviewer had asked about proof that scholarships and reduced rates were denied by camps, YMCA, et cetera. So that's all I have. Thank you.
The only thing I'm going to add is, I know Lynn kind of added this last week, but some of the money and the requests being the same are due to COVID and not knowing where things are going to be this next year. Some costs were much less during COVID for mileage and consumables and even some staffing. And so just trying to judge where that's going to be is very difficult right now. And so we were just trying to estimate where we're going to be.
Okay, thank you.
Add, so also like that, I don't think this is true for all agencies, but for those who received PPP funding, there's going to, like, you know, that's potentially a nightmare for the auditor.
Yeah.
And so I think that we're going to need, it's going to take a long time to really understand the cost impacts of this last year, and we're not done with it yet. So I wasn't surprised to see these applications come in at the same amount. Also, you'll probably notice that there has already been excess revenue returned in some cases. And when we get to the end of the year, that will probably be the case again. But as Danielle is saying, it's too early to understand fully what that means. And then that PPP thing is gonna further complicate it. So it's hard not to know the answers to these things. It's really hard to do budgets right now, but.
Yeah, budgeting is very difficult this year. There will be excess revenue in several programs. Most likely we're still assessing that, but yes, I agree.
Okay, thank you very much. And we do recognize the uncertainty of the time. Are we ready to move on to the PACE, Consumer Control and Personal Support? Gail?
Fine. So this grant is for $24,267. The focus of this, the target is to train people, to recruit and train people as personal support workers. And PACE is working at this through several means. Questions that I came up with in reviewing this is, first, how long have we been supporting PACE with a grant for this program or a program like this? How many years?
I believe this is the fourth year. We're completing the third year, so this would be the fourth year of funding, okay. If that makes sense.
This is Mel from PACE. I got on board at PACE at 2018. So, and I started the program and stuff. So I help my program director develop it and stuff. And I'm getting to be 2018 to 2021. So yeah, so about 3 to 4 years or something. So.
Okay. Three years. And this is the fourth application for grant money. Okay. Over that period of time, Mel, can you tell me how many people have been trained as personal support workers on this grant?
So in 2018, when I came on board, we were developing the program and stuff, and it was a brand new program and stuff. Last year, pre-COVID, there was a lot more and stuff. I remember we didn't track a whole lot of what the total is, but this year we had a target of 35. I think the year before that was what our close number is. That's why we wanted it to be to have a target number this year. But because of COVID, I had actually had to do a quadruple outreach and doing orientation at least 2 to 3 times a month just to make sure that we recruited a lot of personal support workers. So in a normal circumstances, I think I would have reached that 35 PSW if we had an in-person orientation.
Okay. I guess I'm still confused. You said 35 so far. So is that 14 more than the 21 that were reported in the first two quarters?
So this year, I don't think I reached the 14. I think the 14 might be the 2020, the year before COVID, when we did an in-person, I was able to recruit a larger number and stuff. But I think this year, because of COVID and we did online, I don't think I reached that high of a number in an orientation. I could provide you the exact number since I kind of put it in on our quarterly report. I usually indicate how many people I have oriented during that quarter. Would you like me to provide you that actual number for both 2020 and 2021?
I think so. Here's where my confusion lies. We have on the first page of the grant, it looks like 88 people in program year 2020 were part of the grant. In the first two quarters of 2021, only 21 people, and completely understandable with the situation that's going on with COVID. What I was wondering was, does that 88 people from program year 2020 include people who were trained on the grant in 2019, when you were probably enrolling people, and does this include any people from 2018, or was that just a formation year?
We have all of that reported information here at the office, but this is just for what was reported by the agency to us in PY 2020, is that 88. So that doesn't include previous numbers, but I could get that because I'm sitting here in the office with the reported data.
Okay. And then
I want to mention something about that too. There's a lot of the changes during the time that I was on the 2018 to now. On last year, we were during the specifics of the grant, we were reporting people that I have outreach to job fairs and all those places, because we are building that program and we did a lot of outreach to kind of let everyone know about the personal support worker. But this year, what we did was only report the actual PSW, personal support worker, that completed the orientation. So we didn't report anything that I did on the job fair or the outreach or anything that asked about the program. This year alone is specifically just the people that completed the personal support worker orientation.
Okay, so I think that helps me understand a little bit more. So in 2020, those numbers might include people who reached out, showed interest, but did not complete the training program.
And I attended a lot of the job fairs and stuff pre-COVID just to let everyone know about the program. But this year alone, it's just the people that went through the orientation and completed everything that is to be added to the registry.
Okay, and then it says in under program performance measures, PACE has reported 12 successful consumers and PSW matches since the beginning of this program. Here's where I was going, Mel. I was trying to figure out from the numbers how many people have completed the program and are available as PSWs in your registry, and how many people have been placed. So I think the number here tells me 12 people have been placed, but how many people have fully completed the program and are out there and available to Champaign County families as a potential personal support worker?
So I've maintained the registry at PACE. So every quarter I reach out to everybody to make sure that they are in the registry and still active. So it's a kind of like an ongoing registry. So right now with the program this year 2021, I do keep track of the completed people that attended the orientation. So I could let you know that there's about 40 to 50 PSW on the registry that are active and stuff, and are getting sent out for referrals. Now, I can't tell you that that's the total, because when they are not reaching out to me and they're not responding to update their information, I do make them inactive so that their name doesn't go out to any person and they're wasting that referral. So I do keep track, so every quarter at least, to maintain that contact with the PSW to keep them active. Does that make sense? I do have at least that much on the registry that are available for consumers, but there's people that I made inactive in the previous month because they stopped contacting me.
I think so. Here's my area of interest that all these questions are leading to. I guess I want to know how many people have we truly placed with families over time that have stayed compared to the number of people we have trained. I feel that this is a really important program. I understand the value of personal support workers to families with people with any type of disability. I'm just hoping that the program is being fruitful in a way of offering those support workers to our community. That's where I'm getting at with all the questions.
So I can just, you know, that I actually in this year on the quarterly report, I did track the people that are successfully matched on the program and stuff. So I think this year I reported, our target goal was 5 this year, but because of COVID, we actually almost doubled that amount. We had at least, I think, 9 people that reached out to PACE and self-reported to us that they have found a PSW through our registry and stuff. So with that, so I mean, I thought that was a really good information that, because we are tracking it this year, that we were able to find out that they have found somebody through our referral.
Did you say 9 people? I couldn't quite understand.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. It is about, I think, 9 people throughout the year that they told us that they have found somebody through our referral.
Okay.
All right.
The chairperson is going to remind people that time is ticking away, and this is good discussion, but we're taking a lot of time on this. So the group has to decide if they want to continue this or not.
I am through with my questions. Okay. That covers and my issues.
Georgiana?
One more thing that I just want to say, that we provided a 2-page explanation to Lynn, I think Sherry and I, that maybe answer some of those questions that we elaborated
You did. That's the kind of information that would be super helpful in the application. So if the board awards this contract, we'll ask you to add that to the application forms. That should have been, I mean, it's great information, but like we would have loved to include it in the program.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Georgiana, did you have any further comments on this one?
No, I do
not. Then you are next up for the next one, which is Community Choices Customized Employment.
Okay. Let me get my ducks in a row here. All right. The Community Choices Customized Employment Program, if I'm understanding it correctly, people who join Community Choices are the clients of the people, but Community Choices exists. It's a coalition of parents and families of people with IDD. So the roster includes the people with IDD as well as their families or loved ones. So the people who use the services are both. And what I'm wondering about is some of the things that come under program performance measures in our little write-up here. It talks about within 14 days of referral, 90% of those referred will be assessed. Can you explain what that assessment is all about?
Sure. And just to clarify, the participants in this particular program, as opposed to Community Choices as a whole, we are run as a human services cooperative. The employment program, as well as our community living program, you don't need to be a member of Community Choices in order to participate in those. You're certainly welcome to be, but it doesn't change the order with which you're served in our employment program. It doesn't get you any more or less services. So the program total participants in the community or in the customized employment program, those are just specifically adults with intellectual disabilities. So this one doesn't include family members as its total program participant count. But when it comes to the assessment, the assessment that we do in terms of eligibility is actually the pre-screening for the PUNS list. And so that is not something that we do internally. So that happens with through regional planning with their ISCs. And so we say 14 days. Some people come to us with that already, like we've got our piece of paper that says we're on the PUNS list. Okay, great. We're able to move forward with that. For some people, they come to us and they're not sure if they're on the PUNS list, or they sometimes they're not. And so we'll help them, you know, if they need to figure out which documents they need to sort of collect and take over to regional planning with them, we can kind of give them some assistance with that. So it is an estimation. Most folks were able to get that sorted out within about 2 weeks. From there, we do an intake process with everybody, regardless of which programs you are wanting to participate, if you're wanting to be a member or not. And that's just basically to verify eligibility. So being on the PUNS list, we get to know the person a little bit. And then if they're interested in employment, a lot of times they'll tell us right off the bat, and we'll bring in somebody from our employment program to just do that conversation with them ahead of time so they kind of understand how our services work. And then our target is to begin doing discovery with folks within 30 days of their kind of entry into the program. So like usually that intake date is often kind of when they would sort of go on the waiting list or sort of be on our up and coming employment list, if that makes sense. So once we do discovery, which takes, I don't know, anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks with folks, sometimes currently right now, like our COVID has kind of set our whole like process of getting people started in a very, our time frames are a little bit odd. So it's a little harder to estimate. But the hope would be that, you know, once we finish discovery, we would be able to start with them right away. But if not, they go into sort of like a standby period where we know the person, we know the type of work that they're looking for. And while we're out looking for employment and connecting with the different sorts of employers, if we see something that's going to be like a really great fit for that person, we'll go ahead and help them get an interview, fill out an application, et cetera. while we're kind of waiting to make sure they have that sort of real personalized support. Because, you know, and really the effort with that was to help people, you know, if you're waiting on the waiting list, which has been the case, I think, for most employment programs around the state, including ours, that people lose motivation. It takes a lot of effort to sort of say like, hey, I really need help with this. I want to go out and get a job. And then to say, hey, you've got to wait 3, 4, 5 months in order to get started can be really kind of a blow. And so by starting that discovery process and letting people know that like, hey, we're keeping an eye out for you, and not just like in general, but like with the specific types of themes and environments and employers that person is specifically interested in, I think it kind of helps people like stay engaged in the process, even while they're still waiting for that slightly more personalized one-on-one weekly applications and interviews and sort of learning process.
Thank you. Thanks for
a long answer.
Build up a lot of that. I mean, you took care of about 3 of my questions right here.
Okay.
I only have one more question, and it's under the, I'm not sure where it's under. You say people develop a personalized employment plan, and your goal is 20 people on. And I'm wondering, is that a year or a quarter or what period of time?
Yeah, so that is over the course of the year. And that personalized employment plan, we developed that with the people who've done discovery with us. And so it includes all of the kind of ideal conditions that person is looking for in a job. And then the way we sort of break it down is that sort of classic discovery model where we come up with the themes. And then there's other sort of like logistical things, sort of like risks or strengths that sort of are associated with that person's specific job search. Those go in there as well. That's something that we create with the person. If they have an involved family, that family is also involved, really anybody who they would like to be involved. But those 20 people are the 20 people we're doing discovery for and then doing the active job placement for. Some of the numbers also include the folks that are maybe employed right now who are continuing to do that sort of follow-along support. So people kind of come into the program and move through it in an episodic way throughout the course of the year. And sometimes that does stretch over a couple of years. But hopefully that explains that piece of it.
And again, the goal of 13 people will work to obtain employment. That also is annually.
Correct, yes.
Okay. Really, that's all the questions that I had. I think this application is pretty self-explanatory, and I don't have any more questions. I don't know whether or not Deb does, my second on this.
Just a couple. Becca, 10.4% increase. Just for clarity, what do you propose to do with that?
Sure. So some of that is a cost of living increase sort of for the staff. We also have done a little bit of restructuring with the way our sort of administrative support has been working over the past couple of years. So for a long time, I was the only one who was providing any of the indirect support beginning in 2019, middle of 2019. We brought Hannah on as our associate director. So we are starting to shift a bit more of that indirect administrative support to her position. And so some of that is just a shift between like the administrative support that's associated with that program compared to the staff. So if you look at the total number of like positions, the employment program this year also goes up by like a quarter of a person. we're not going to be hiring, obviously, you know, one person to do, you know, 15 or whatever hours a week. But it is just sort of a rebalancing, I guess, of where that administrative support is associated with each of our programs.
Okay. And then under total program revenue, it says CCDDB request is 75%. Other sources are the CCDDB DSC Employment First subcontractor, $20,800.
Yes, I'm sorry. I think I call it a different thing maybe than is on here, but that is our LEAP Employment First project that we do with DSC. They sort of submit the grant and then we invoice them.
Oh, so got it. Okay, I didn't quite get what that meant exactly. And then Final question. The audit revealed material weakness regarding segregation of duties related to the organization's accounting procedures and processes.
Is this one of our mistakes, Becca?
Or is sorry?
Is this one of our mistakes, or is that an issue that your board approves each year?
Yeah, that is one that we approve each year. So the standard accounting procedures are that you have three separate individuals who are involved in the accounting process. Again, because we're a small organization, we only have two. And so the essential difference is that I both sign the checks and approve the invoices. Oh, okay. When we get the power bill, I'm like, it's cool if we pay the power bill. And then I also, sign the check that goes to the power company.
Got it.
So I think it's something our auditors have told us is very typical for smaller organizations without sort of a more extensive business support staff.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for that clear answer. Any more comments about this program, or shall we move on? Let's move on to Developmental Services Community Employment. Sounds kind of familiar.
Okay, I guess I'm the primary reviewer for this one. DSC has asked for $361,370, which is the same as last year's funding. Of course, COVID. So they've explained that throughout the pandemic, service delivery has been fluid and responsive to increases and decreases in COVID-19 cases. Obviously, there was a big change this past year in how people were employed and if people were employed during all of this. But they've explained that their employment specialists were able to maintain already established relationships with management of long-time employers using virtual options. I'd like to know a little bit more about that, because if we're talking about employment, how do those employment supports happen virtually?
Can you tell me what's going on with that?
Deb, can you repeat the question? I think Annette's on there now.
Yeah.
Yes.
I wanted to know what page that was on.
That was under your the scope, location, and frequency of services. Really, basically, the narrative that explains the program.
Page 53.
Okay.
Yes. I'm sorry. Page 53.
Yeah. The online and virtual was really about doing the discovery process with job seekers. And it has been challenging. And I think one of the challenges of this year was that people's interest in actively looking for a job ebbed and flowed, depending on spikes in COVID positivity. So a lot of families, because of health concerns of family members, were not interested in their job seeker who lived with them meeting in person. And okay. There were no community places to meet. So a lot of that was done virtually. And a lot of that was just really to maintain that connection or to better develop that connection with the job seeker until both the job market and people's comfort with getting back out there opened up again. And that's actually what we're seeing right now. Just within the past 4 to 6 weeks, we've gotten several people jobs, interviews are happening, and because we've been able to kind of keep those relationships going, that, that was the virtual piece of that.
Okay, thanks for explaining that, Annette. I thought, that it relates basically to discovery, those things that you would do outside of the actual employment setting,
right,
with the individual participant.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you. One of the challenges is, and I think people get discouraged when you're looking for a job. If this goes on for months and months, to get people remotivated is sometimes pretty challenging. And,
sure.
Just maintaining those relationships was very helpful.
Okay. Well, that was really basically all I had for this one. Other than I would encourage DSC to continue amping up their measures of client satisfaction and their outcome data in measurable ways. I really value that information. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue. Do you have anything?
I don't.
Okay. Well, then guess what? Your primary reviewer on the next one, which is the DSC Community Choices Collaborative Employment First Program.
Okay, this program is a little different. It's, I think, a great example, and Becca already said it, that Community Choices invoices DSC for their participation, Community Choices. So it's a great partnership, I think, between the agencies. It also focuses on Champaign County employers and businesses. And it's a grant that talks about changing the culture in terms of hiring people with disabilities. And it's also referred to as, they do LEAP training for employers about hiring people with disabilities and questions. They have very specific outcomes in terms of activities. You can see so many trainings, 25 LEAP trainings, a newsletter every quarter. They do follow activities with the with the businesses that they train. And I think those are very good. I know this has been a different year. In the future, I'd love to see not just the activities outcomes, but how many people have gotten jobs as a result of the training and how many employers have hired people with disabilities as a result of the training. It's the same request as last year. There's not any increase. So that's all I have.
All right, thank you, Sue. And I'm the second reviewer, and I would second everything that you said. I think this is a unique program, and it's a great model of collaboration and reaching out to the community. And somebody should write an article about it for the New Yorker or something about the work that you all are doing. So very good.
I just have one thing. They also have met their CLC program requirements.
Yes. And we hadn't mentioned that up to this point, but thank you very much for bringing that forward. Right. That's very important. Part of this review.
And I think across the board, I think with regard to that, across the board, that we need to continue to do outreach to underserved populations. We still have a ways to go in that.
Thank you, Sue. Amen. Next, Community Choices Self-Determination Support. Georgiana, you're up.
All right. This is the program that is for both the people with IDD and their families. And the scope of the program is to provide family support and education and to build community amongst the IDD community. My questions have to do with, again, numbers, because I'm kind of a numbers person. The projection for this coming year, this program year 2022, I believe is 170. And I kind of just want to maybe have somebody like Becca or somebody elaborate on how they get their projections. Where
how do you project how many people might use your services? Are they all considered to be new people or just people continuing to use the services?
Sure. So, and we did, there was one, we did make a mistake in the non-treatment plan client section. So our total projection of 170 is the combination of folks with IDD as well as their family members. So we estimate about 80 people with IDD and 90 sort of additional people, generally parents, siblings. Those estimates are based upon we do annual membership and then we do a renewal that starts every year in the spring. So technically our sort of like membership year, it aligns with our fiscal year. So we have generally somewhere between 60 and 80 members at any one given time. And so those estimates are based on kind of our historical rate of renewal. Folks who don't renew, and maybe, you know, we have people sometimes leave for a year or two and come back. If that's the case, if they are gone for a while, those people will get counted as new. I think we do break it down in terms of, in the application, you know, of the 80 participants with IDD, I think maybe 65 are going to be continuing clients. So those are folks who are going to sort of renew their membership with us. And then the additional 15 would be new people who come to the organization for the first time or come back after a number of year gap. And then the family members, most people come to membership with at least one other person sort of as sort of part of that family unit. And that can be, we include anybody who is sort of active in that person's life. So it might be mom and dad, it might be mom, dad, sister, or it might be just the person. And so some of those are estimates. And then if we have events that are open to the public, which is part of the grant, we also, we do our quarterly co-op meeting. So if there's a brand new person that comes to that that's not a member, we do include them as one of those family member non-treatment plan clients.
So this 170 is a combination of IDD people and their family. And the frequency that you talked about in here, frequency of services, I guess, activities, your co-op meetings, your family parties, your support groups, social opportunities, what you quoted in here, the numbers, those are obviously must be from the program year 2020, because that's the only finished year that we have, correct?
Yes. So again, this was a hard year to estimate. we sort of went on a slightly optimistic sort of projection of things that we would be able to, I think, you know, do the same number of things that we have done in the past. A lot of those things we've actually been able to translate to some virtual settings relatively well. So things like our co-op meetings, some of our family support groups, we've been able to do over Zoom. And that's worked quite well. Our in-person social opportunities, those ones have been a little bit more challenging, given, you know, how sort of difficult the winter was and how very inside focused it has been. But that is something that we have gotten back to starting this month. We are doing those things again. And we're hoping that throughout the summer, those things will be possible as well. But no, this is a program where we do a lot of different things. Some things are happening very frequently. Some things happen on a quarterly basis. And we are continuing to do our daily Zoom sessions for our participants with disabilities who want to sort of sign in and see other folks. And those continue to be something that is offered that we've been doing sort of throughout the pandemic.
Did you say daily? You do those daily?
Yeah, we do 7 a week. So we do one every day, and then Tuesday, Thursday, we do a longer one in the afternoon.
And that's with your consumers or anybody that wants to.
Yes, correct. We send out a weekly calendar on Friday afternoon, and then a daily link to whatever sessions are happening that day. So it usually goes out around 9 o'clock. The first one's at 10, and that goes out to all of our members who have asked to receive that. There's a few people who are like, I'm not interested, but for the most part, it goes out to all of our members, and we usually get anywhere from, I would say, between 5 and 10 people at each of those.
I was going to ask, what is the usual representation between 5 and 10 people? That's not bad. Not bad. It's something for people who are stuck at home to have some connections. I understand that totally. And then really, I only have one other question, which I think you've answered already. Where you refer to assessment. Assessment must mean determining what is needed for this family, this unit, this person with a family. Is that what assessment is, of determining what is needed?
Again, here the assessment is also sort of status on that PUNS list, just to determine sort of eligibility. I think the way that it's phrased within the applications, it's like it's assessment of eligibility. And so for us, anybody with an intellectual disability, developmental disability, is eligible. And sort of the criteria that's used for that is the PUNS list. So it is sort of external from our organization. We don't do a specific assessment internally to say if you can or cannot use our services. We do have an exploration process that we do with people within this particular program, which is, it's based off of CQL's POM, personal outcome measure, which is a long interview where we essentially are just trying to figure out what is the person interested in. If they're wanting to build connections, kind of which direction is that? So that is different than the assessment as it's written within the within the application, which is that PUN screening. But that is something that we do for those who are interested as they enter membership.
Okay. And to clear up one more thing, when you say you determine status on the PUNS list, a person does or does not have to be on the PUNS list to receive services from this program?
So they do need to be on the PUNS list to receive the majority of services. So any of those personalized services, those one-on-one connections that we're building with people, folks are always welcome to, if they still want to be a member and they want to come to our family parties, come to our co-op meetings, they're more than welcome to do those. We just don't count those in our sort of service contacts. But yes, to do the social opportunities, to do the one-on-one connections, if they're like, hey, I'd really love to get connected with a dart league, those things we would ask that the person be on the PUNS list, as that's sort of the way it's written in the contracts.
Okay. I do not have any more questions about this. I think that it's a very useful program, not only for the IDD person, but for the families of the IDD person. So the other person that was working with me on this was Gail. Gail, did you have any questions?
Two, and I hope they'll be very quick. With consumer access, it says PUNS enrolled adults. We understand that now. Members of community choices. What percent of your membership is involved in this program?
So the entire, I'm sorry, can you come back? So the entire membership is included in that total count. So this is the program that is essentially Community Choices membership. We don't require a sort of a level of participation. Some people we see every day, and some people we see, you know, a couple times a year. So there is a fair amount of variation in that. But 100% of the people who we count as members of this program are also Community Choices members.
All right. The second question is in the financial analysis, page 62 or page 3 or 4, increase in funding 11%. CCDDB funds are 90% of your total funding for this program. Is the increase based on a fall in contributions and fundraising, or just an increase in needs or costs?
So we are actually planning to add a halftime position to this program. And again, this is in relation to sort of that rebalancing of the administrative load within the organization. So Hannah, whose position has been housed within this program, she's going to be taking on more administrative duties. And so we're going to be hiring, hopefully, somebody who can do more of that person-to-person support within the program. And so a lot of that increase is related to that additional halftime role, as well as a small increase in cost of living for across the board for the staff.
Thank you. That's it.
All right. Thank you very much. Next up is Developmental Services Community First, and Deb, you are the primary reviewer.
Okay, this is our biggie. This is the funding request is the same as last year. It's for $847,659. The intent of this program is to get individuals actively engaged with the greater community, integrated, included, and hopefully based on their discovered interests. New activities cycle through in, I think, 4 month periods. I am imagining there's still a great reliance on virtual service provision due to COVID. And I'm hoping that sooner rather than later, people will be able to safely resume some of the great activities that were provided pre-COVID. My questions primarily are on wait list time, how many individuals are on that list on the average at any given time, and referencing a couple of reviewer comments on page 65. Following the area that starts estimated level of change, there's been a request by the reviewer that choices should also be clearly indicated in an individual's person-centered plan. And that, again, referencing outcomes, which is always a big deal to me, that the outcome that is says people try new things, I would love to see what happened when they tried new things, more information about that, and to have better information about how their activities were chosen, how they know that they are, that their preferences have been taken into account. Just a question, pre-COVID, how much time on average in a given week of day services did a participant enjoy this program versus remaining in-house? I was wondering if somebody could answer that.
Okay, do you want me to start in order of your questions or does it matter?
Sure. If you need to clarify or break that down in it, feel free.
Okay, I was kind of scribbling as you were talking.
Tunneling through.
As far as waiting list, I would have to get that information. I'm not sure how many people on at a given time are on a waiting list.
It would be helpful for us to know, better understand the need.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes when people are waiting, some groups, as you mentioned, there are 4 month cycles. There are some groups that people can jump in kind of mid-group. And okay. Then there are other groups where it's more kind of an educational group or class that kind of builds on a foundational skill. And then you're kind of building on that over the 16 weeks. So sometimes people have to wait until the next cycle.
Yeah, are there people that really want to get into this program who are usually in-house during the day pre-COVID who just can't because there's no space for them?
No, typically everybody who wants to get into it is able to. The only time that they cannot is if they're interested in more than one group that's happening on the same day. So there are typically 7 groups every single day. And some of those are offered just one time per week. Others, like maybe some of the exercise programs, you can't just exercise one time per week. So a group might meet Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
Okay.
So if they're interested in multiple offerings on a given day, then they make their choice. And how we do that, their program writer or the employment counselor who is their primary person will sit down with each person individually 2 to 3 weeks before the new groups are going to start, and they'll talk about each group and kind of what the group is going to be about. And all of these groups that have been developed based on the interest of the people who are participating. So what we've kind of done to make it easier to manage the schedule is we already know what day of the week the groups are going to happen. They're told about all six or seven of the groups that are going to happen on that day. And then they choose choice one, two, or three, so that we know their highest preference is number one. But if other people have already, you know, expressed an interest, then we go down to the second choice, and so on. But most people, yes.
Can you just for context, give a couple of examples of the groups, so that everybody kind of knows what activities you're talking about as you refer to groups, but they're so broad.
Yeah,
I think it would be helpful to have a context. Sorry.
Thank you. And you know, some of the groups, and I'll try to think of an example while I'm giving some of the examples. So, a lot of art or art expression. Right now, one of the most popular groups is card making, and there is a co-leader for that at this time. Seasonally, during the summer and spring and fall especially, there are a lot of activities that are based on the outdoors. We've had bird watching groups. We've had groups that go to all of the local parks and they're learning to identify trees. We had a group that participated in a nature watch where you actually reported what you saw and it was included in a database. A lot of exercise. During the summer, the one that probably has a waiting list is the garage sailing and fishing. You know, we help people learn how to fish, how to bait their own hook. I don't know that many people take the fish off the hook themselves, but I wouldn't, that's for sure. You know, since COVID's hit, some of the groups have changed to more virtual and online. The podcast group is an example of that. And the way that's kind of morphed through their interest is it started out with just listening to podcasts, learning how to access podcasts, how to choose one, et cetera. And then the more they did that, the more they were interested in making their own podcast. And that's how our podcast team was developed. So I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Yes, thank you. I believe that Sue, you were secondary on this?
Yes, and I don't have any further questions. I was interested in Annette's answer on the waiting list and the outcomes. The questions you asked, Deb, how activities are chosen and pre-COVID, how many people were served in-house and how many people were in the community?
If I can kind of speak to that a little bit, I was hoping I would get asked the question about, you know, transitioning to community only. You know, this program, there really was a long-term vision of kind of turning a cruise ship. You know, when we first started this program, it took a lot of effort to get the initial five people interested in stepping outside their comfort zone and accessing the community more. And so every year, you know, our goal has been to increase time in the community and decrease time in center. As we're looking, and this is, I'm speaking more to my part of the program. I know Laura Bennett has talked about the people served through this program. There are a handful that are served by her program that require a lot more personal care support, or they really are not able to tolerate long forays into the community. And, you know, work is done to kind of increase their ability to tolerate that over time. But for the people in my part of the program, as we get ready to look at reopening, 74% of the people funded by this program are community only. Oh. And then, and so that's a huge change, you know, over the years. And 13% are kind of a mix of, they still want to participate here, but they also want to do some community connections. And then the last 13%, they're just kind of the last holdouts. They're really interested in just being here. You know, one person is looking at retiring, and, you know, so we just continue to honor what they want, but continue to encourage them to be more involved. You know, we don't stop encouraging that.
So Annette, the last people holdouts, quote unquote, they would be probably a little bit older, like you said, for right. retirement. Okay.
Right. Yeah. And in fact, you know, when, you know, as people are funded, you know, they're pulled from funds and they're funded by the state. And in my part of the program, as, you know, people come in, they're not given the option of in-center. We meet people in the community. We go to their house to pick them up. You know, they really don't have a connection with day program other than, you know, they might be in the same groups as some people who are doing both. And, you know, one of the individuals we did make an exception for, he had a community job. That job went away. And, you know, physically his body is just not doing well. And physically he continues to deteriorate. He wanted to come back. He wants the connection, you know, with people here. And, you know, he's now talking about retirement because physically it's just pretty difficult for him. We had another person who did the same thing. He did not want to do groups. He only wanted to do work. But during COVID, he's been home alone. He lives in his own apartment. And he retired from work over the past year, but he is open to at least doing one-on-one with somebody now to help him get out. You know, so that's another person who typically was in center for, you know, his entire day, but now we'll get services outside.
You know, I just, and I think that makes sense. I think there's a lot of people, disabled or not, who have gotten used to being, you know, maybe they're more introvertish, have gotten used to being in all year, and it's hard to start getting out again. I think that's not unusual.
Okay, thank you very much. Is that it for that one? That was very substantive. Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
It's one of the best.